In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with sociologist Michael Burowoy, someone who, within his field, is very well known for the kind of writing and research that he's done on the lives of working class people and their communities. And he has done this by not only writing and observing, but by participating, doing the kind of things that often we think of anthropologists doing, where he goes and actually lives with people, sharing their daily lives and doing their work. And he has done this in a variety of places, in Hungary, in Russia, and also in southern Africa. In recent years, he has begun to turn his critical eye on his own field of sociology, arguing for something that he calls public sociology. And in this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about what that means. He sees this as a way for academics, people in universities, to be more involved in forming social policy, at least encouraging dialogue on important public issues. And also he makes the argument that it's a good way and also very important for universities to connect with the larger community. He will also be here in Champaign-Urbana at the end of this week to talk about this very subject. And this is a program in that series of talks called the MillerCom series. And we've had a lot of those folks here on this program. He'll be speaking at 4 in the afternoon on Friday at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. This is sponsored by primarily by the Department of Sociology, many other co-sponsors. All of these events are always free and open to the public. So anyone who is interested in attending should feel free to stop by Levis Friday afternoon to hear the talk. On this program, we do these kinds of conversations so that we can bring the guests and their ideas to people outside of Champaign-Urbana. So anyone listening is welcome to call in with questions. All we ask of people is that they try to be brief so we can keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone's welcome to participate. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here you have questions, you're welcome to call. Professor Burowoy, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Very good, David.
We appreciate it. There are a number of things that I'd like to talk about, but I think perhaps people might be interested in learning a little bit about how it was that you arrived at what has been the focus of your work. That is, looking at the lives of working class people and not just sort of standing back and looking, but actually going and doing the job, working alongside people. And you've done a lot of hard, rough, dirty kind of manufacturing work. The kind of things that probably a lot of academics, nothing against academics, a lot of academics have not done. I think that in a lot of people's minds, that's gained some admiration for your doing that, plunging in, rolling up your sleeves in a very literal way and doing the work. And I'm interested in how it is that you decided that out of all the many various things that you could study, that's what you wanted to look at.
I suppose it began where my academic career began, and that was in Africa, in Zambia, and that was in the years 1968 to 72, where one of the issues was the racial character of a post-colonial regime. Zambia became independent in 1964. It had been a British colony until then, and when I arrived there in 68, I became very interested in the question of what was happening to what had been called the color bar, that is the relationship between black and white within industry, whereby no black really received, no black ever had any authority over any white. And I was wondering what happened to this color bar. And the only way to really examine that was to really go in and, as you say, get your hands dirty, go in and observe and perhaps even participate in the industry itself. I was particularly interested in the copper industry, which was the mainstay of the Zambian economy. And so I managed to get myself a job in the Zambian copper industry and observe firsthand what I later came to realize was, in fact, the reproduction, the maintenance of the color bar through a whole series of manipulations that white managers engaged in at that time. And it was something that, as I say, one could only really study firsthand. There was no way of talking to people outside work. You know, is there a racial color bar in your work site? People will be very suspicious of any such questions. And the whole racial question was a very sensitive one. It was something that really, in fact, in my case, I did only sort of incognito. I went in almost into false pretenses. It was the only way to see what was really going on. Mm. And when I, you know, when there was a afterwards, there was a, you know, when this became a public issue, and I suppose this is was one of my few moments of public sociology. This was very widely debated in Zambian society on television, in the media. And I think led to some changes in the industry itself.
Hmm. Well, that, I suppose, gives us a nice opportunity to take the next step and perhaps talk a little bit about public sociology,
mm-hmm.
and what that means. And it seems that here you're confronting the question that so many people, I think, in higher education, in colleges and universities confront, at least they ought to. And that is, what exactly is the relationship between what they do in their research, in their teaching, in their classroom, within the boundaries of the university? What exactly is the relationship between that and the way that people live their life outside of the university? And so often, the criticism of the academy is that there isn't very much relationship between those two worlds. And it seems that at least within your field, this idea that you've introduced is an attempt to build some connections,
right,
between the two, at least between the academic discipline of sociology,
right,
and the rest of the world.
Right. Well, there is always a connection. Just in describing my research, I've obviously participated in the world beyond, and most sociologists do that, and have really, in a sense, translated what one learns outside, or the experiences I had in different work situations, translated that into a research program, theoretical schema that I develop in the context of the academy and engage with in relation with other academics, mainly sociologists, but also anthropologists, economists, political scientists. So there is a process of translating the lived experience outside into a academic language, but the public sociology is in a sense a back translation, a retranslation back of that academic world, that academic theory that develops within the somewhat cloistered institution that we know as the university, translate that back into knowledges that are appropriated, can be applied, and can engage, and I'm particularly concerned with this latter issue, engage publics in debate about the direction of society. Mm-hmm. So it is a retranslation back, and both translations going forward from the world to the university and from the university back. These are actually quite problematic and difficult and fraught with a lot of debate within the academic world.
Yeah. Certainly over the years, I have been doing this for now more than 20 years, and I've talked with a lot of social scientists, people from different backgrounds, about their work and their research, and many books have been written and reports have been written and papers have been written. And so people talk with each other. They talk within their discipline. Sometimes they talk with guys like me who work in public radio. But you do wonder just how outside of this sort of circle of specialists and people who specialize in talking with specialists, does it really go any further? And why it is that it seems that for people in the, we'll just pick the social sciences just because that's what we're dealing with, why it is that it seems so difficult for what they learn and what they think about, the understandings that they try to gain about society and how it functions, how people function as individuals, how people function in groups, why it is that it is so difficult for anything they learn to go the other way, That is to go from the academy, the university, from right. there back to the world.
Right. Well, let me say first, of course, there are some disciplines that seem to be more effective in doing this, and economics, obviously. I mean, the concepts, ideas of economists do actually sort of flow beyond the academy and are picked up in media and spread all over the world, actually. And indeed, that's, I should also say that in our role as teaching, as teachers, we're constitute students, as I say, as our first public, and they are, you know, they're ambassadors for, in my case, sociology. They take it beyond the university. But you're right. I mean, there is also a problematic process, and I think in part it's problematic because we are a profession in a sense, and we are concerned with as a profession with our own interests in monopolizing knowledge, and one way of monopolizing knowledge is to make it esoteric, and I think some of that esotericism is helpful and useful, and but a lot of it is obfuscatory, and I think people who sort of believe in public sociology believe that, you know, if we have anything to communicate, it should be sort of communicated beyond the university, and we should break it down into ways that make it accessible. And there have been great examples of public sociology. There are famous books that, you know, books like David Riesman's The Lonely Crowd in the 1950s was read very widely. More recently, a sort of parallel book about American individualism written by my colleagues here at Berkeley, Habits of the Heart. Even a book perhaps even more recently of a different character, a study of called Heat Wave by Eric Kleinenberger, a study of the 1995 heat wave in Chicago and how 700 or 800 people above and beyond what was normally the case died, and he examined how this natural disaster was actually something that was socially produced, and looked at all the forces, the social forces within Chicago and beyond, that conspired to generate this this unusual epidemic of death, and showing that it was not really just a matter of heat, that it was a matter of the way that Chicago politics, media, society is organized.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Michael Burroy. He is a sociologist. He's on the faculty at the University of California, Berkeley. They're in the Department of Sociology. He is currently the president of the American Sociological Association, as a matter of fact, and is known for his writing about work and about the lives of working class individuals. He'll be here on Friday to talk about some of these ideas as part of a talk in the Millercom series, and we always try to have some of these people on the show for the benefit of all those people who are listening who couldn't attend the talk. It's a way of bringing the conversation to a larger community. We think that's a good thing. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I know you've observed is that this debate about public sociology, or the fact that sociology and sociologists should have this kind of public role, seems something only that we have here in the sense that apparently if you go to other countries outside the United States, they would, if you started talking about sociology, they'd say, well, what are you talking about? Of course, they don't seem to question this idea, and they would say, well, in fact, they would say, well, we're doing that already. Now, it may be different as you go from one place to another.
Right.
But it seems that that level of involvement seems to be more characteristic of other countries than it is of the United States.
Right. 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 Well, I think that's definitely true. I go almost every year at the moment to South Africa, and many of my ideas about public sociology have been inspired by my observations over decades of what had transpired under the apartheid years in South Africa, and the role sociology played in broadening the consciousness of different groups, classes in society. And there, you know, sociology is public sociology. It's not only public sociology, but it certainly is a powerful moment in the sociological enterprise. It's understood widely that it be part of the wider society, and that sociologists sort of generate debate and discussion about the direction of society. Interestingly, in this post-apartheid world, the leaders in South Africa are now saying to sociologists, well, you've done your work, you know, you sort of basically sort of help broaden the consciousness in the apartheid years, and you help build the trade union movement and the civics and the social movements in the cities. But now we got our new society, the new South Africa. Your role is rather different, and you should sort of retire back to the university and
go back to write papers,
and you should spend your time teaching. And on top of that, there is pressure for academics to orient themselves to Western journals and be accredited in an international context, all of which sort of draws the social scientist away from the publics to which they had such a close relationship before. It's becoming more American-like, and I go there and explain what the American model looks like, which is, as I say, a model of social science which is very centered on professional identity, as it is nowhere else in the world. And this professional identity is one that sort of defends the autonomy of the profession and develops its own internal criteria for what is good and bad work. And many of the sociologists in the professional world think that we should separate, should we clearly demarcate sociology as science from a set of political and moral issues, that we can really only be objective in our scientific role if we bracket political and moral issues. And so there's a big debate. I mean, the idea of public sociology, where professional sociology is strong, the idea of public sociology is a controversial issue. Many sort of are very skeptical about it and are worried about its implications for the credibility of sociology as a social science.
It strikes me that also what this, if you look at the differences between attitudes in other countries on this issue and the way it is, we tend to think about here in the United States, that it also maybe says something about the fact that we seem to be sort of conflicted about the idea or the role of the public intellectual. We're just not really quite sure about that. We certainly don't have, it seems like we don't have much honor for people who take on that role. And that we're really not quite sure how we feel about it.
Right. There is an ambivalence from many sides. And, of course, the contrast is with a country like, I don't know, France, where, mm-hmm. you know, the public intellectual is like a Hollywood celebrity. And there are not many of them, but the ones that are, they sort of receive a lot of attention. We just don't have those sorts of characters. And I suppose, I mean, within academia, there is some skepticism towards the public intellectual who pronounces judgment on all manner of things and not necessarily on the basis of expertise. I'm trying to pursue a slightly different project, which is the public sociologist as a specialist public intellectual mm-hmm. who makes pronouncements on the basis of expertise that has been accumulated in the academy. So it's a sort of narrower version of the public intellectual. But you know, the problematic character of the public intellectual in this country is in part linked to the problematic character of publics. I mean, I think it can be said that we don't have a very dense, thick set of publics here that you might find in other countries with very different political histories.
Well, perhaps I should ask you to sketch that out a little bit more. Some people might hear that and might be not quite sure what it is that you mean by publics.
Right. Well, I think most simply put, I mean, they are audiences for, shall we say, public intellectuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, who are the audiences? We can think of public intellectuals who, for example, write in the New York Times op-ed pages. That's for some is the height of the public intellectual, is to engage in somebody like Paul Krugman, who writes regularly for the New York Times as a public intellectual, and the public there is the readership of the New York Times, which is it's a relatively thin public. I mean, the readers don't often sort of communicate with one another. It's not like a social movement. It is of a national character. It's a sort of liberal mainstream thin public. That is one public. But there are other ideas of publics, and for some sociologists, for example, collaborate with their communities, with neighborhood groups, with religious groups, communities of faith, or with environmental groups. And that's a different sort of public, a much thicker public, and often a public that is much more engaged and closely engaged in an unmediated way with the sociologist. I think that many commentators, political scientists, have particularly been prominent in making this argument that, in fact, we live in a world, in the United States, the civil society, the groupings, the voluntary organizations, these associational activities in American society have diminished over time. Mm-hmm. And that it's an increasingly sort of a barren terrain for social scientists. I don't subscribe to this view, but I do recognize that sociologists in particular have a lot of work to do in gaining contact with these other groups, associations outside the academy. Often those associations and groups have political views that are dissonant with those of the sociologists, who tend to be more liberal than the average American citizen. But when I talk about publics, I'm really talking about these associations that become audiences, potential audiences of the social scientist.
Yeah. And then I guess it gets me back to, maybe this is a little bit broader issue, but the feeling that we do have this. There are the people who write for the op-ed page of the New York Times, and there are the people who read it.
Right.
The people who, the relatively small number of Americans who are passionately engaged with thinking about important issues, and then maybe within that small group there are even smaller groups that are politically polarized that mostly talk with themselves.
Yeah.
And occasionally throw things at the other side.
Right.
You know, and that then the vast majority of Americans are in the middle and just trying to get from one day to the next.
Right.
And that they're really disengaged from the conversation that,
right,
that is engaged in by these elites,
right,
mostly talking with themselves and sometimes with each other. And it seems that the constant question is, well, that you would like to engage more people in the conversation, because after all, some of the things that we're talking about really do bear on their daily lives, and sooner or later it's going to come down to them in one way or another. But
right,
but how is it that you make some kind of connection between between the group where the intents, you know, are consumed with thinking about and talking about ideas and issues,
right,
and everybody else?
Right. And of course, the media have got a big role to play in this.
Mm-hmm.
And since so much is controlled by the television media, and it's so difficult to get complicated messages over through television, that's a real handicap in this country, I think, is the way that the media is governed by commercial interests. I mean, the sort of conversation we're having today is a very, in a sense, is the best possible circumstance for a sociologist. I mean, we have a considerable amount of time for me to elaborate my ideas, and you are already acquainted with the sorts of things that I do. So this is a genuine conversation. But these sorts of conversations, I think, take place all too infrequently in the United States, and perhaps are much more part of the political culture in other countries. both third world countries or global south and other European countries.
Yeah, and I guess I sometimes when I think about or hear about what people are talking about these days within my area of work, I wonder sometimes whether how much longer in even in public radio we're going to do this.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. It's as I've said before in this program, it's kind of old school public radio, and I'm not quite sure
how long you can last. Well, I hope you last.
Well, I appreciate that. Questions, all by the way, are welcome for people who are listening. Our guest, Michael Burroway, is a professor of sociology at University of California, Berkeley. We'll be here at the end of the week talking in the MillerCom series about some of these very ideas and in a talk titled The University and Its Publics, Global Challenges for the 21st Century. Questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's make the connection here to the university, because I think that also one of the ideas that you're interested in and we'll be talking about is why it is important for the university as an institution to think about in maybe in the way that you're suggesting for sociology and sociologists to do, perhaps other disciplines as well, to think about the idea of public engagement more than it has in the past.
Yeah, well, I think it's the case that particularly the public university is under attack, and I assume that in Illinois it's no different from elsewhere, that there are various budgetary crises that seem to be pushing the university ever more in the direction of private donors, and this has all sorts of implications for university autonomy. Mm-hmm. That there has been a marketization of admissions. There have been increased corporatization projects, public-private partnerships. At Berkeley, there's this famous Novartis experiment in the plant microbiology department, and the rise of distance learning, and then there are a whole wide range of issues around increasing inequalities in the conditions of faculty themselves. So the university is really under a lot of pressure from the outside and is responding in ways that are not always conducive to the learning and teaching and doing research. And so I think that this is a particularly important point for academics, and I think particularly social scientists, to begin to pose the question of the university. Clark Kerr, who died recently, was famous for his The Master Plan in California and his idea of his book, famous book, The Uses of the University and the Multi-University. I think we need somebody of his sort of stature to begin to start rethinking, and there are people, of course, who are doing this, rethink what the university is and what it could be. And I think that debate should be one in which the university reaches out not just to elites, to corporations, but to a much broader swath of the public. Mm-hmm. And particularly if we're thinking about the defense of the public university as such. And we need to see that one of our obvious publics, our obvious clients, one of our obvious interlocutors must be not just the elites, but the different publics we serve directly, whether it be in our teaching role or our research role.
We have a caller and would welcome others in who have thoughts, questions, comments. The caller here is in Edwardsport, Indiana. So we'll go there on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just had a question about what he thought about the social structure in Iraq, and has he studied that, about the differences in cultures of the three main, you know, the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds, and why we didn't take a better look at their social structure before we decided to do this, if that has any bearing on it.
Well, I know that's a little outside of his area, but I would certainly give him the opportunity to speak to the question whatever the way he would like.
Right. Well, no, I think this is one of the sort of questions that sociologists should have things to say about, and I think they do have things to say about Iraq. I myself have not studied Iraq. I've never been to Iraq. Not even been a worker in Iraq. I think it is interesting. I think sociologists have a lot to say about the American presence in Iraq. There is actually a book that Michael Mann, a very well-known comparative historian, sociologist, wrote a book recently called Incoherent Empire. And the argument is essentially that American occupation of Iraq is an occupation of a colonial character in a post-colonial era, that you can militarily occupy a country, but to build a nation from the stand of a military occupation is an impossible task, as we find out increasingly from day to day. And I think the sociologists are generally very skeptical of the possibility of building a society through military means. Indeed, I might say that this time last year, there was a resolution, a member resolution came to the members of the American Sociological Association. It was an anti-Iraq war resolution saying that without support from a wide variety of international bodies and without support from other nations, any preemptive strike against Iraq would create more problems than it solved. And there was, a rather prophetic resolution. And much to my amazement and the amazement of many others, this resolution actually passed with a two-thirds majority. Suggesting that, in fact, even though this is very rare that sociologists or even social scientists through their professions make resolutions, and in fact, the American Sociological Association was, as far as I know, the only association that did make such a resolution. It is very rare, but it indicated the deep concern that sociologists had with the conduct of American-Iraq relations. So I think the sociologists have indeed a lot to say about the ways in which world international relations should not, in that, not perhaps so much as how they should be, but certainly how they should not be organized, and have much to say about the presence of the United States in Iraq and the implications of that.
Okay. All right. Yes. Thank you for the call. Well, you know, I think it does raise an important point, or make an important point. I think at last night, anyone who listened to the president.
Hello?
Yeah. For some reason, the last caller didn't get cleared off the. There we go. Didn't clear it offline. For anybody who listened to the president last night in his press conference, he said the kind of things that he has said previously in talking about why it is he feels it's important the United States should be in Iraq. And he said, essentially, as I hear it, he said, it's important for us to be there. What we're doing is we are remaking Iraq in order that we may remake the Middle East, in order that we may remake the world, essentially. I think you're saying that. And when people ask this question, why is it we went into Iraq in the first place? It turns out to be a very complicated question. The answer is there is not just one thing, but that kind of idea that the president had outlined clearly was in the mind, if not in the president, of the people that advise him, and it was in their minds long before September 11th. So, but now then the criticism comes that here is yet another example of our tendency to try to remake the world in our image, as if as if Iraq was no different from the United States. And that seems to be the precise point, in fact, that Iraq is a different country. It is not the United States. And you just simply cannot do that. And yet the U.S. government, and not just this one, has shown again and again that it thinks that it can. And that it seems that we, at our peril, we fail to understand that other countries, other cultures, other societies are very different from ours, and that you cannot simply take a set of ideas from the United States and lay them over another culture. It's just not going to work. And we keep trying, and it doesn't work, and somehow we never quite get that.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think that, unfortunately, the social sciences are implicated in this too, that the social sciences in the United States often do tend to universalize the very particularistic experience of the United States. And I don't exempt sociology from this, that we have had models of how things change, of how modernization takes place, sort of singular models that are inattentive to the particularities of society where change is to take place. I think economists, if I'll excuse me, are probably the most guilty of this, in that they have this what one of my colleagues calls a monocropping view of how economic change takes place. And there is this, that very economics has a sort of relatively homogeneous singular research program organized around the importance of the market and the conditions under which the market will expand. And this has proven to be, in my own experience, a disaster. I've done a lot of work in Eastern Europe and what was the Soviet Union, and saw precisely how the Big Bang theories of market development created such a disaster, particularly in the Soviet Union. And it was not simply an imposition by the United States. It was not simply some think tanks at Harvard that sort of propagated the transition to a market economy. But it was actually, there were interests in the Soviet world and in the post-Soviet world that were congruent with that image, because, of course, what happens when markets intrude, that they generate enormous inequalities, and some groups benefit from the markets, but most get dispossessed of their means of existence. The death rates in Russia have gone up considerably since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and in large part due to the market economy that has expanded there and destroyed the whole infrastructure, societal structure that existed before. But anyway, I totally agree with you that we are as social scientists and an American population at large, and particularly the American state, does work with a sort of unilinear, singular sort of vision of how things should to take place, and often brings military force to bear and imposing that vision, and it just is very incongruous and in tension with local social structures, local cultures, felt naturally rise up and resist. I mean, we've had many reasons for why the occupation of Iraq has not worked. There's always some scapegoat, but the underlying theme is that this is a form of imposition, a bureaucratic military imposition on a very diverse, divergent set of cultures. And that resist domination, and that's going to happen everywhere in the world where the U.S. tries it.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have a number of callers. We'll try to accommodate those folks. And again, introduce one more time our guest, Michael Burrowoy. He is a sociologist. He's on faculty at University of California, Berkeley, and is well known within the field as sociologist of industrial work. He's currently the president of the American Sociological Association, and will be here in Champaign-Urbana at the end of the week to give a talk dealing with these very issues that we're here discussing. Let's go on to the phones, and next caller is in Lafayette on line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm finding the discussion very interesting, kind of bringing together questions of sociology and psychology and economics. And again, I'm going to bring up the topic of this dialogue of the death. Dialogue of the death between kind of an inter-civilizational dialogue of the death or a bad marriage between, quote, East and West.
Uh-huh.
But I was it seems that economics really does play a big part of it, but the average American really doesn't seem to have any conception or understanding of economics and how it affects themselves and how it affects other people and how they may be linked economically to people in the rest of the world. And so I'm just wondering also about issues of identity. It seems that people get very emotionally wrapped up in their identity, whether it's working class white males who very much back President Bush, and they seem to be the strongest group that's doing that, the least likely to question, or whether it has to do with Islamic identity. So I don't know if you want to go further into that question. You've already said quite a bit. But I find that we don't really talk about the economics, but we may talk about, you know, other issues like identity, but they seem to be connected in terms of, you know, people get very emotional about cultural differences, but they're supposed to be working in the same economy, but in fact they don't want to be necessarily controlled by the same economic forces.
Right. No, I think identity issues are very important, but they often spring to the fore when peoples are threatened economically or dispossessed economically. They take on a particularly keen vigor under those circumstances. But I think there's another aspect of your question is a matter of communicating understanding about the world in which we live, and I think there we social scientists have failed to really, and there are reasons why we fail, but we have failed to communicate effectively, both at home and abroad, the nature of the world we're living in. And part of my project of public sociology is also to give it, in a sense, de-parochialize American sociology and to make we sociologists aware of our connections to worlds beyond the United States. Obviously, many sociologists do study other worlds, but I think we have got to be much more effective in communicating the ideas that emerge from our studies in different parts of the world, to appreciate its plurality and the different identities that do emerge under different circumstances, to project that out beyond the university. So it's not just a matter of us defending the university that's on attack, but actually I think that the world actually needs more sociology, and it needs sociologists to make even bigger efforts to communicate their findings to broader publics. So I think that social science has a lot of work to do, but you're right, there are immediate economic pressures that we don't comprehend, that we feel we don't control, that often leads us to form into groups that sort of defend our often quite narrow interests without building bridges to other groups.
I appreciate the caller's comments. And again, we're kind of short on time, so I hope she won't mind if I go, and we'll go to line 3 and someone else in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'll make my question broad also. The phenomena of the political polarity that exists today is this historically common, or because we live in a free society where people can believe more or less and express their feelings, a common thing. Let me be just one more specific. I don't understand how people can be so different but be so alike across the board. How your neighbor may be pro Iraq war, for example, and seem to have so much in common with yourself, and then it's just curious. I didn't phrase my question very well, but if you could address that in some way.
Yeah, I think the question is pretty clear. Professor Burrow-White, do you want to take a run at that?
Well, I think it is one of the interesting phenomena that we find in many, not just in this society. In fact, this society is relatively mild form. I mean, many societies, one day we are friendly neighbors, the next day we are warring with one another. Yugoslavia was a case in point. But, you know, revolutions break out all over the world. They have historically, and they continue to do so. And revolutions spring from a society that one moment is integrated and the next moment is exploding along very deep divides. And I think it's the function of the sociologist actually to understand how that can come about and how those divides were there beneath the surface and how they, at one particular moment in time, exploded. So I think, yes, that's the sort of puzzle we face in our day-to-day lives, and it's a puzzle that we sociologists spend a lot of time thinking about.
We're down to the point we have a couple of minutes left. If we might just turn it back to the university for a moment, and for all the people who are not involved in the university, you'll have to forgive me for gazing inwardly again. But I think I raised the question just because I think there are some people who feel that this is a particularly dangerous time for the idea of the university, in the sense that there is this idea out there abroad in the world, and worse, in state legislatures, because they're the ones that appropriate the money, this idea that what happens in the university doesn't really matter, that it's just, that so much of it is essentially trivial and frivolous, and that that's a pretty dangerous idea to have for people to have about the university if we think it's important for there to be public support.
Indeed. And that's why we need public sociology, we need public social science, we need public everything, but particularly the social sciences, I think, are have to bear the burden of communicating the importance of the university, that's my project.
Is there at least some good conversation going on among academics about this very issue, do you think?
I think that is definitely the case. I think, for example, within my own profession of sociology, I go around the country talking about public sociology to different departments, universities, associations, and I've received an enormous interest and I might even say enthusiasm for the idea. I think there is an increasing recognition of the importance that at least sociology, but I think it extends anthropology. I know this extends to anthropology and probably to political science and some economists. There's a really great urgency about the great concern about the way the world is going and how important it is that we as social scientists communicate what we have accumulated over time. So I think that there is an increased sensitivity to the importance of the public role of the university and of its disciplines.
Well, we will have to stop there with the, again, further mention that our guest, Michael Burrow-White, will be talking about some of these very ideas in a talk. This is part of the MillerCom series, The University and Its Publics, Global Challenges of the 21st Century, Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. It's on Illinois Street in Urbana. They are free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested is welcome to attend. Michael Burrow-White is a sociologist at University of California, Berkeley. Professor Burrow-White, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, David.